We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
After weeks and weeks of wrangling, Congress and the president last month came to an agreement on a budget for the fiscal year that was already at that point half over. And then, at that moment, a debate shifted to the budget for fiscal 2012, which is only 6 months away. And that battle, as it is an election year, 2012, promises to be much bigger as people argue not just about where the money should be spent, but over just what the role of government should be. In this hour focus, we'll try to talk a little bit about the budget and the process involved in putting it together, perhaps explore some of the key issues here, including things like taxes and deficits and the debt ceiling. And our guest for this hour is Alan Schick. He advises members of Congress and congressional committees on budget issues. He's done a lot of studies at all levels of government on budget systems and policies on public management. He's a professor of public policy at the University of Maryland. He's also a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and has written a number of books about the budget and one you might be interested in taking a look at if you'd like to get some basic understanding of the budget process. That book is The Federal Budget, Politics, Policy, Process. He's also founding editor of the professional journal Public Budgeting and Finance. He's joining us by phone. And as we talk, questions are welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. We have an email as well, so if you'd like to send in your comment that way, you can take that opportunity. And the address is will-talk. At illinois.edu, so WILL-talk. That's what you want to do. Otherwise, you can call us 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. At any point here, questions welcome. We do hope people will be on topic, and we'll try to be brief. But if you can do that, we'd be very happy to have your call. And Professor Schick, hello.
How do you do?
Thanks very much for talking with us. We appreciate it. I don't know if you just, having been someone who has been watching various budgets, I'm sure, over time made, and the negotiations that take place between the two parties and between the White House and the Congress, do you have any particular reflection on either what's happened to date with the finally coming to an agreement on the year that we're already in, and then how things shape up as we move into another fiscal year, which also happens to be an election year?
Well, the agreement they reached for the current year was one which had a lot of cosmetics to it, advertised more than $30 billion of cuts. But when you put it under the microscope, most of those cuts either vanished or were off in the future. And so that indicates to us that on the one hand, both the Democrats and Republicans, both the White House and the Republicans in Congress, want to reach an agreement. Neither side wants to be blamed for a stalemate or for economic collapse that might occur. But neither side wants to give very much ground either.
Mm. Well, what the big news maybe, or the big challenge, was when Representative Paul Ryan from Wisconsin threw down the proverbial gauntlet. So he came up with this budget plan for 2012 that he said would cut the deficit by $5.8 trillion. That is over the next 10 years. Yeah, not just in 1 year.
Right.
It would make some pretty big cuts in discretionary spending. There were big changes to be made to Medicare. Now I think the Republicans have started to back away from that. But just how significant do you think was the plan that Mr. Ryan put forward?
Well, it represents the heartland of the Republican position, and most Republicans in Congress would embrace it if they had a free ride on it, but they don't. Particularly on Medicare, he hit what we call a third rail, and the Republicans have come to realize that Medicare, like Social Security, is something that you can only change with the fingerprints of both parties on it. Either party alone is putting itself at great risk.
Yeah. It seems the main focus here of the conversation is in deficit reduction, and the only difference is perhaps between the Republicans and the president is just how quickly they intend to try to reduce the deficit.
No, that's not how quickly, how they get about it. I mean, the Republicans want to take the position that you can't, that you're not serious about the deficit unless you want to are prepared to restructure federal responsibilities and obligations. As long as the federal government has the same exposure, Republicans believe that we're not going to be serious about deficit reduction. The Democrats take the position, however, that the role of the state is embedded in society and that you can make serious inroads in the deficit by raising taxes on some and by realigning some of the expenditure obligations of government without kind of redrawing the boundaries of the state.
Well, that maybe we could get to have you talk a little bit about where it is, essentially, when you're talking about federal budget, where the money goes and why it is that that it's so difficult to reduce spending.
Well, there are a few big pots of money. They're not the ones that get the headlines in terms of government spending poorly. Social Security is one, $600-700 billion a year. Medicaid and Medicare together line up with that another that amount. Then you got defense and interest on the public debt. You're talking about these four pools of money accounting for maybe two-thirds of federal spending.
And the other third, is that the money that we generally refer to as discretionary spending?
No. I left out some other entitlement.
Oh, okay.
The word discretionary in Congress means the amount which they appropriate each year, and defense spending is also appropriated each year. So technically, defense spending also is labeled discretionary. What I was leaving out were some things which have the characteristic of being entitlements, but they're neither Social Security or Medicare or Medicaid.
Well, that I suppose that does get to this issue that people toss around this word discretionary, and there is discretionary, and then there's discretionary. In the sense that, yes, the defense budget is discretionary, but it's also something – so it's open to being cut, and yet it's very difficult to talk about cutting it.
Yeah, that's correct. All spending is difficult to be cut because when government spends, it creates armies of people who benefit from those expenditure, and they're going to want to protect their interests. So whether it's technically an entitlement or it's simply what we call discretionary, in both cases it's hard to cut.
Well, that does it. If one is the argument, I think that a lot of people make is that the federal government simply spends too much money, or at least that it should spend less.
Right.
Is it possible though to, in a significant way, cut spending without cutting some of these? You can't just do it by cutting the stuff that's easy to cut. You're going to have to cut the stuff that's difficult to cut. Where that means that you have powerful constituencies who would want to defend those appropriations.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let me be clear. Uh-huh. You can achieve cuts. For example, in farm subsidies, that's something which is very much on the table right now, in the operating cost of government. The problem is not that you can't get cuts. The problem is that the size of the problem is so very large. We're talking about something in the vicinity of $7 trillion of deficits over the next decade. That's the CBO, Congressional Budget Office, projection, $7 trillion of deficits over the next decade. So it's the magnitude of the problem that challenges government and their politicians.
Can we talk a little bit about deficit, just because I get a little confused, at least because one hears people either saying that that's a big problem and that we need to aggressively move to reduce it, and then there are other people who say, well, yes, it's something we ought to be concerned about, but the question is just how aggressively do we get at it? So do deficits matter or do they not?
They definitely matter, especially because we've accumulated this vast stock of debt to other countries. So when I mentioned $7 trillion of buildup of additional debt projected over the next decade, we're talking about it added to a mountain of existing debt in excess of $10 trillion already.
Mm-hmm.
So it's that's the problem. Now, if you mean by does deficit, do deficits matter, will the sky fall in? The U.S. economy collapse, and the dollar become, a worthless piece of paper.
Mm-hmm.
Interest rates score into a double or triple digit stratosphere. Inflation get out of control. Probably not. That is not the risk we're looking at. Well, the risk we're looking at is more subtle and yet equally dangerous of a long-term erosion in the financial, economic, and political position of the United States.
Now, I also came across a report. The Congressional Budget Office released this report in March, looking at the deficits and how much they have gone up recently, and make this argument that, one of the reasons the deficit's gone up so much is that we've been through a recession. And during a recession, outlays for federal programs to help people who are out of work, things like unemployment compensation, go up. This report also argued, apparently, that as the economy improves, that spending for those sorts of things should go down. And, in fact, the deficit will shrink even if Congress does nothing.
Yeah, but the $7 trillion CBO forecast for the next decade does indeed assume that the economy recovers.
Mm.
In other words, the economy will recover, but not sufficiently so that we can grow out of the problem. It's a mistake to think that this is a problem that economic growth and prosperity will take care of. We have a fundamental mismatch between what citizens expect from government and they're willing to pay to government by way of taxes. And as a consequence, even with economic growth, we're going to have this severe imbalance.
Our guest in this hour is Alan Schick. He's professor of public policy at University of Maryland. He's also a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, someone who has done a lot of writing over the years on issues of budget. And that's what we're talking about here, the federal budget. And questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line. That means if it would be a long-distance call, use that. That's 800-222-9455. And if you'd like to send us an email, you can do that. It's will-talk@illinois.edu. Let me ask you just another question about the accumulated debt of the country. It seems, back at the turn of the last millennium, that it was still pretty significant. But over the last decade or so, there's been a big bump up in
That's
debt.
Correct.
Why did that happen?
I think the main reason that it happened is a lot of the blame has to go to George W. Bush and his presidency. And I'm not making a political statement here. I'll mention two things about the Bush presidency. One is it was probably the first time in U.S. history that we both went to war in Iraq and then Afghanistan as well and cut taxes. That didn't square. So we vastly increased defense and related expenditure at a time that we significantly cut taxes. And secondly, Bush was a kind of populist president. He was a president who was for low taxes, but as a president who, on his watch, we significantly increased federal spending. It wasn't, and I'm leaving aside defense spending, it wasn't the case that he says, I want low taxes and small government and less spending. He was a populist in the sense that he wanted both low taxes and increased expenditure. He's not the only one who has the blame, but I think it was on his watch. You mentioned from beginning about 2000. If you draw if you look what happened at 2000, in 2000, the concern in the United States was what would happen when we pay off the entire debt of the United States. There was actually projections that said that we will do that, that we will be debt free. And then over the next decade, eight of those years were in Bush presidency. Things spiraled out of control.
Let's go to the phones and talk with some people who are listening. We have a couple of callers here ready to go. They're in Champaign, and we'll take line one first. Hello, go ahead.
Good morning.
Yes.
I had two questions. One was rather specific, and the other is general. The specific one was Paul Krugman, from the New York Times, pretty much dismisses Ryan's plan as A, not doing anything in the near term anyway, and B, being essentially smoke and mirrors in terms of what he does do in the general. Maybe I'm mischaracterizing him. But I wonder if you could evaluate his analysis a bit. And then the second point is a general point. Why can the French, for instance, have a system that, you know, has generous medical benefits, as I understand, good retirements? Why can they afford it and we can't? And I'll just listen off air, but thank you very much.
All right.
Okay, well, the question is whether the French can afford it and we can't. We can afford it right now, right? What bad things are happening in the United States? If you were a Frenchman visiting the United States and seeing the deficit and the headlines, et cetera, say everything's okay, right? The malls are filled, the roads are clogged, et cetera. The country hasn't collapsed, et cetera. So what you found in France is what a Frenchman would find in the United States. When we talk about the difficulty of sustaining a deficit position or a debt, we're talking not about the next few days, what will happen May 10th, which is tomorrow. We're talking about 10 years from now or 20 years from now. We're talking about a long-term erosion of the fiscal position of the United States. As for Krugman, he likes to have it both ways. On the one hand, he dismisses Ryan as smoke and mirrors. On the other hand, he says, God forbid if Ryan was adopted, civilization as we know would come to an end. Mr. Krugman or Nobel laureate Krugman should not really have it both ways. Right? Either Ryan is muscle and means something, and you can't dismiss it, or if you dismiss it, don't say it does bad things.
And your personal opinion?
I think that Ryan is going to go nowhere, but it was gutsy, and with some tinkering of it in terms of how you pay the premiums, what its risk and exposure Medicare people are holding, the tax structure of the United States, there's room to argue. You know, if there's a fundamental agreement, and I don't mean it just a patch for 2012. If there is a kind of fundamental agreement, you'll see elements of Ryan in it.
Just for a second, going back to this question about why a country, for example, like France, should not have the difficulties that the United States does, and I'm sure that there are other countries that do, and certainly recently in Britain we've seen aggressive efforts to cut government spending. I find myself going back to your comments about the Bush administration and thinking about the amount of money that we spend on defense. Is that the biggest difference, say, between a country like the United States and Britain, Germany, France, another industrial democracy?
No. Certainly not. I mean, defense spending, including the buildup, including Iraq, Afghanistan, and all the rest of defense, is what, 4% of GDP? So the gross domestic product. That itself doesn't explain it.
Mm.
Yeah, so it was a mistake to not to raise taxes when we went to war. You know, you should pay for defense obligations. But that's not the main factor. The main factor is the United States is a low tax country. In other words, we've had, if you compare the tax yield of the United States in 2010, 2011, to 50 years ago, as a portion of the economy, it's not much higher than it was then. Part of that, again, is because of the recession, which you mentioned earlier. And part of it, Americans don't like to pay taxes. All you listeners know that we went to war against the British more than 200 years ago with a battle cry of taxation without representation is tyranny. The battle cry in 2011 is taxation with representation is tyranny.
Mm.
They don't even like it if it's gone through democratic processes. The French, by the way, pay high taxes compared to the United States, very high taxes compared to Americans.
And for the benefit of anybody who, and we probably still will hear from people who want to tell us that they think their taxes are too high. Of course, everybody thinks their taxes are too high.
Especially the 50% of American households that paid no income taxes last year.
So there, this was a story recently reported by USA Today. In fact, based on Bureau of Economic Analysis data, shows that Americans today pay 23.6% of their income to cover federal, state, and local taxes. But from the 70s through the 90s, they were paying more. They were paying about 27%. So, in fact, the tax burden has gone down.
But more importantly, it's shifted from the state and local level to the from the federal level to state and local level. State and local taxes have gone up. Federal taxes have gone down.
So in fact, the way people feel the tax burden, particularly maybe on the state and local level, that maybe we wouldn't blame people for saying, yes, they feel that they're being more heavily taxed.
But keep in mind that how we feel about taxes is, in a way, a referendum about how we feel about government itself. When people in a sour mood about government, they don't trust in it, they don't have confidence in political leaders, then no matter what the tax burden is, they think it's too high. And that's been a problem. If we look at not tax trends, we look at public opinion trends about how Americans feel about government, particularly the federal government, over an extended period of time, we find that trust scores are in a downward trend.
And there we get to the a lot of people saying that they think that, in fact, this very question, that's going to be right at the center of the campaign that we're going to see next year.
That's certainly the case, yes.
Let's go to another caller. This is Champagne, line two. Hello.
Yeah, hi. I have a couple different questions. One is you mentioned 50% of people paid no taxes last year, and
no income taxes.
Right. So who is that group of people? And my question is, like, because it seems like there's a huge group of people, especially the people up there in Congress that are voting and things like that are against increasing taxes on the rich. What are the pros and what are the cons of increasing taxes, particularly for that income bracket? And then one last comment is just, you know, in terms of some of the federal subsidy things like welfare and things, I don't understand why some of those programs like welfare, for example, people couldn't be made to, you know, for the money that you get if you're on welfare, that you have to work as a volunteer somewhere to at least help. It's not, because then it would make people feel better about the fact that these people are getting this the welfare money and that they're turning around and they're contributing something through volunteerism or whatever. But anyhow, mostly my question is about the who paid the didn't pay taxes and the rich didn't.
Okay. Well, the 50% that don't pay taxes are generally, with some exceptions, but overwhelmingly, in the lower end of the economic spectrum. They earn less money, and the federal income tax system is highly progressive, even though sometimes reading the papers or hearing that programs, you wouldn't believe it. We have one of the most progressive tax systems in the world, by far, I might say. And so consequently, lower-income people, even reaching into what we call the lower middle class, their federal income tax liability gets wiped out. They don't pay it. Okay, they often think they pay it, but they don't. Okay, and that leads to the question: if we need more revenue for government, and I'm on the side of those who think that we do, from whom do we extract that additional revenue? And this is there are three sets of arguments that you have. The Republican argument seems to be extracted from no one. Government should trim its sails, its footprint, roll in the boundaries of the state. We can make do without higher taxes. Unfortunately, I don't think their numbers add up. Okay. The second argument, which is Obama's argument, is that the upper 2% of taxpayers, the numbers he puts on it, individuals earning more than $200,000 a year, households earning more than $250,000 a year, their taxes should go up. Okay. He's probably right that their taxes should go up, but he doesn't realize that no matter how much you tax them, there's not enough money there to really correct the fiscal imbalances. Okay. So upper income people probably should pay more, but if you're only getting from them, you're not getting enough. And that leads to the third argument, which is the commission that the president had established, as Bull Simpson is called. We got to levy taxes across the spectrum of American people. All Americans should have some obligation for paying the cost of government. Not necessarily the same. We want a progressive system. But you can't find enough revenue just in the upper income taxpayers. And that's where my own views lie. You know, upper income people should pay more, but you can't extract enough revenue from that source alone. Okay? About welfare and work, that's a complicated story because, first of all, welfare programs, what we specifically call welfare, is a tiny part of the federal budget today, really, really tiny. There are other federal programs, more specific, which provide assistance to low-income people. Pell Grants for college, for example, Medicaid to provide to assist in paying medical bills, and food stamps for nutrition, and so on. Okay. One might argue that these people would be better off in having a sense of obligation to society if they contributed work. But there are many of these people who you simply can't get work from them. What do you do with a young mother, a single parent, who has three young children, and tell her, you know, put in work? It won't get us very far.
We are about at the midpoint of this conversation here this morning in Focus. Our guest is Alan Schick. He's professor of public policy at University of Maryland, also a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, has done a lot of writing and speaking on the issue of budgeting, including authoring the book The Federal Budget, Politics, Policy, Process. And we're talking about the federal budget. And questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I have another caller here, line one, Champagne. Hello.
Thank you. Well, first of all, I always get a little annoyed when I hear people say that 50% of people don't pay taxes, as if the federal income tax was the only tax that was significant in people's lives. I mean, they pay a lot of money, and you know, for somebody in a lower income range, a high percentage of their income or a high percentage of their money goes to paying payroll taxes, which have a cap on it for wealthier people. But you know, there are a lot of other ways of getting revenue than just focusing on the income tax. I mean, we're not very enthusiastic about taxing wealth in this country, and you know, something that we used to do and that other countries still do that could bring in some significant income would be to put a small, say, 0.25% tax on security exchanges. You know, when people buy and sell stocks and bonds, and you know, we don't tax hedge funds. There's lots of places out there that, you know, we could get more revenue and, you know, could have some other beneficial effects for our society. We could institute a progressive tax on dividends and interest so that, you know, it wouldn't be a big burden on people who have, you know, a little bit of money in index funds for their retirement and that sort of thing, but somebody who's, you know, bringing in hundreds of thousands, possibly millions of dollars a year from dividends and interest, maybe they pay a little higher percentage on that. So there are other ways we can get a little more creative than just relying totally on the income tax.
Well, I assume that when you say raise rates on dividends and interest, you're talking about the income tax. So you're back to the income tax, sir. You haven't escaped from it. First, with respect to low-income people, okay, keep in mind two things. One is that at the low end of the income spectrum, okay, even after you take account of paying payroll tax, what we call Social Security and Medicare taxes, that for these people, they are receiving more back from government in income transfers that they're giving to government. In other words, they have a negative tax rate. That's what the data show, a negative tax rate. Secondly, with regard to middle-class people on Social Security. Social Security tax payments are regressive, as you pointed out, but what you get back from government is highly progressive. So if you want to ask yourself a question about the overall progressivity or regressivity of the Social Security system, you shouldn't look just on the taxes that people pay. You should also look at the benefits they get. My final point on generating additional revenue in terms of closing loopholes, I don't think you use that word itself, but hedge funds, dividends, et cetera. I definitely share your views about it. A lot of these loopholes have no justification other than the political support behind them. But I want to repeat what I said earlier. With all the loopholes, the United States still has just about the most progressive tax system in the world. Keep in mind, the United States does not have a VAT, a value-added tax, which falls very heavily on low- and middle-income people, and almost every other country in the world does have a VAT. So when you the dust settles and you add up all the tax burdens in the United States compared to other countries, even though we have all these anomalies, loopholes, et cetera, we have a highly progressive system.
We have some other callers we'll get onto in just a moment. Our guest in this hour is Alan Schick. He's professor of public policy at University of Maryland. We're talking about the federal budget. We'll have more after a short break. This is Focus.
I'm David Thiel from WILL-TV. Join me this October for a Friends of WILL tour of London, Yorkshire, and Wales. We'll see stately homes and splendid scenery with connections to some of our most popular TV programs. Three-night stays in each of our locales offer us plenty of free time. Call us at 217-333-7300 or visit will.illinois.edu for more information.
This is Focus. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here with 10 different topics every week. On the program tomorrow, we'll have our monthly show on lawn and garden care. On Thursday, we'll be taking questions on children's health. Dr. Malcolm Hill will be here. He's a pediatrician from Carl. On Friday morning at 11 o'clock, we'll have some more of the shows that we're calling the Deep Archive, celebrating our 30th year here being on the air. Some programs that are in our tape library, but have not been heard in a long time. You can get the complete schedule for this week, next week, can look ahead, can also listen to some programs you might have missed the first time around. All of that is on our website, will.illinois.edu. In this hour, our guest is Alan Schick. He's professor of public policy at University of Maryland, a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, has advised members of Congress and congressional committees on budget issues, has done a lot of studies at all levels of government on budget, and is author of the book, The Federal Budget Politics Policy Process. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And if you want to send us an email, you may do that too, will-talk@illinois.edu. We'll get back to the phones here, and I believe next we'll talk with someone in Urbana in line number two. Hello.
Yes, I heard what you said, that if we tax the increased taxes in the top 2%, it won't be enough to improve the deficit. However, I've heard economists say that if we cut taxes on the top 2%, that would largely increase our economy. It seems like you can't have it both ways. If it's not enough to improve the deficit, it's not enough to improve the economy. Or, conversely, you know, it's enough to improve the deficit and the economy at the same time.
Good question. The argument that cutting taxes on the top level or any level would stimulate economic growth is generally labeled supply-side economics. The supply-siders would have us take the tax rate down to zero. In fact, there's very little evidence to support their argument. Keep in mind that during the Clinton presidency, we actually raised tax rates, particularly on the upper level of people, shortly after Clinton became president in 1993. And the data show a robust economy through the remainder of the century, the next six, 7 years. So supply side is a lot of noise and very little evidence.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. And we will continue, and we will go next to a caller in, another caller in Urbana, line three. Hello.
Hello. Professor, perhaps you've read the recent column by syndicated columnist George Will, writer for the Washington Post, in which he stated, the headlines, U.S. Defense Department budget really is beyond comprehension. And he quoted a couple of congressmen. I'd like to read them briefly. Randy Forbes, a Virginia Republican, said that for 4 years, the Defense Department has not complied with the law requiring auditable financial statements, and he charged that, quote, none of the budget is even in a position to be audited. Senator Tom Coburn said that the Pentagon is one of the few agencies in the federal government that cannot produce auditable financial statements in accordance with the law, end quote. So here's a government entity that spends $1.5 billion, perhaps even $2 billion a day, and they have not complied with the law for auditability in 4 years.
Well, let's separate two aspects of the Defense Department. One is it's an extraordinarily complex operation. There's no entity in the world which approaches the U.S. Defense Department in complexity. And you have to distinguish between failure to have what we call a clean audit, which means that there are really problems there, and failure to have a clean audit because of the complexity problem. Having said that, I'm strong on the side who believes that there's probably oodles and oodles of waste in the Pentagon. And some of them, all of them are difficult to weed out, whether it's gold plating a jet aircraft, so it has to have so many functionalities that it drives up the price to close to $1 billion for one plane, or therefore it can't perform all its missions, gets to be too heavy, for example, or pilots getting combat pay for doing nothing, et cetera. On down the list, there are tens of billions of dollars of waste in the Defense Department. But the blame does not lie in the Defense Department alone. Just this past week, when Secretary Gates tried to make minor cuts in defense, the kickback from Congress was extraordinary, you know, and he was going to lose most of those arguments. We'll have to see whether the new Secretary of Defense, Panetta, has any more success. So, yes, the Defense Department is the world's capital of wasteful spending. But blame doesn't lie only in the Pentagon. It lies in the defense industries, in Congress, in the whole, what Eisenhower in his famous farewell address called the military-industrial political complex.
Yeah. Well, that given that, does that give you, do you have any hope of us being able to get a handle on that?
Optimistic, no. Hopeful, prayerful, yes. In other words, it is so important for the United States to bring defense spending into line, you know, and it's going to be very hard to do.
On again to LaSalle County, line 4. Hello.
Yes. The first of the year, they reduced the employees' percentage to the Social Security by 2%.
Right.
Do you know how long that is going to be in effect?
Yes, just for this calendar year.
Oh, this year only.
Therefore, comes, and I might add something. The spike, the increase in gas prices has entirely, or just about entirely, offset the reduction in Social Security taxes. So the family, which is paying less in Social Security taxes, is paying more in gas expenses, and therefore it doesn't see any gain.
But I thought that was a very stupid move because of the fact that they threaten all the time that Social Security is going broke.
They papered it over by Uncle Sam making a cash transfer, a bookkeeping transfer, I should say, to Social Security, so that it's getting that money back.
Well,
in my
book, if the little guy that only makes $30,000 to $40,000 a year pays in on every dollar he earns, why is there a ceiling? That ought to go right up to, I don't care if they make $500,000 a year, they should have to pay the same rate of tax. And
okay,
like the self-employed, Now, listen, the self-employed, they gave no break to. We didn't get 2% off on the self-employed.
Yeah, they give a slight break, but you're right.
What was it?
It's what?
12.4.
Yeah, but it's not a double 7.65 is the combined Social Security and Medicare tax. And if it were no break, it would be double that, so it would be about 15.
Well, that was where the break was. They gave it to the employee, but not the employer.
Yeah, I understand. Yeah, I don't want to get technical, but if you look at the tax return, there was a break on the first part of the return before you calculate what's called AGI, adjusted gross income. But back to your main point. Okay, let's assume we buy your argument that the cap ought to be removed on Social Security taxes. So you pay Social Security taxes on your total income rather than just on the first $110,000 or so.
Yep.
Would you agree that the benefits also should be adjusted upwards?
Of course.
If there's a connection between the two.
Of course. This is somewhat like a savings plan, and those that put more in should get more out.
Well,
but
then
they would have more money.
Okay. So I agree with you, but if I agree with you, then we're saying that raising Social Security taxes by removing the cap won't generate all the benefits of the government because they'll have to write bigger checks to beneficiaries.
Well, we don't need bigger checks, but we need to get out of the doldrums of being told that in X number of years this is going to be broke and you'll have nothing. And then it gives the young people the idea that, oh, what the hell, I'm paying into this, but I'm never going to get anything out of it. And I hear that over and over and over.
And they're wrong about it.
So, and I tell them they're wrong,
yeah.
But how can they not think that way when the government is telling them that it is going to go broke? And that goes on all the time, and I get a little tired of it.
I can't defend the media for saying Social Security will go broke, because the evidence is that it won't go broke. If you want to talk about what will go broke, then you got to shift the argument to Medicare, because that's really in trouble. And Social Security, while it has some difficulty, is really quite far from a crisis.
Let me. I want to thank the caller. I have some other people. Let me ask you an email question here, I don't know whether you can answer it or not, but the caller here makes reference, person writing in makes reference that before the Bush administration the tax cuts and the wars, that we were actually on target to pay off the national deficit, national debt. The person writes, ignoring the challenges to actually make it happen, how far would it get us if we put things back the way they were before Bush?
Well, it's really hard to put things back because the economy is weak. The U.S. position in the world is not as favorable as it once was, and we certainly can't do it in one bite. So it will take a period of years. The hole we're in right now is much deeper than the hole we're in 20 years ago in the 1990s. And so you can't dig out of it just right away. Look how hard it is in the fighting between Democrats and Congress and Republicans and between Congress and the president to even make a down payment on getting out of the hole.
Well, is it reasonable as a time frame to set and for a deficit reduction, is it reasonable to set a 10 or 12-year time frame, or should it even be longer than that?
Well, longer than that, I think, really loses credibility and saying, you know, it's so far in the future, we don't have to do anything today. The important thing for 10 to 12 years is that we're serious about it. You know, 10 to 12 years can mean one of two things. On the one hand, it can mean that we're taking steady, progressive, continuing steps year by year to put this problem behind us. On the other hand, it can mean that we're simply kicking the can down the road, pretending we're doing something, but not doing anything, and saying we'll do it 3 years from now, 5 years from now, and when those years come, we'll kick the can further down the road.
We have just about 5 minutes. We have another caller here in Champaign County. We'll go there, line two. Hello.
Yes.
Hi. I've heard you say a couple of times that the U.S. has the most progressive tax structure. I don't know if you're just talking about income, but I would say that that's probably true in the same way that the U.S. has the highest corporate tax income tax, because it doesn't. Nobody really pays that effectively. And if you look at the fall off of what the corporate burden was you know, historically compared to now, it's just obscene. And they'll saw about, well, they'll just pass it on to the consumer, so it's always some kind of value added or some kind of sales taxes. Presumes that there is no such thing as a free market where people will opt to shop and be able to actually, you know, change the pricing structure, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know if that's too complicated in such a short moment, but, you know, I'm getting apoplectic again. That Stiglitz was on NPR today, and I really advise people to look at what he's saying because
who is that?
Joe Stiglitz was on with an interview today. For the first time, we've actually heard somebody advocating stimulus again, and not headlong into this deficit.
Not the first time.
You're wondering about. Social Security that the other person called about is obscene, and I'm sorry I didn't come through so well.
Okay, well, Stiglitz has been singing in that choir for a very long time, so he's not the first time. Krugman has been singing in that choir, and it's the liberal end of the political spectrum. When I said that the United States has just about the most progressive tax system in the world, I was not looking at rates. I was looking at actual payments, okay? Now, you're wrong in saying that nobody pays the corporate income tax. There are hundreds of thousands of corporations that pay at the 35% rate. Okay. The problem with the corporate income tax is that at the same time that some are paying full freight, 35%, some are paying zero because of all the loopholes. So it's wrong to say nobody pays it. Some people in some companies indeed do pay it. And the variable, who pays it and don't pay it, depends in part on what kind of industry sector you happen to be in. So that's part of the problem of the tax system in the United States.
Any further comment on the issue of progressivity?
Well, here's the issue. Suppose the United States, by some miracle, which won't happen, gets a VAT, a value-added tax. Okay, a value-added tax without any other correction is highly regressive. So therefore, the only hope whatsoever for introducing a value-added tax, which I believe is maybe the ultimate key, not right away, decades from now, to balance the U.S. financial position, would be to include in it offsets so that low-income people, even to middle-income people, get back something because they paid value-added tax.
We just have a few minutes left. One other thing that I want to talk about, just because it's been discussed and I'm sure will be more discussed here in the next week or so, is the matter of the debt ceiling. And it's been estimated that around the middle of this month that the federal government will hit the level of borrowing that's authorized to borrow. And it's going to have to be increased. I don't know that anybody really thinks that it won't be. But the question will be, well, what will Congress manage to demand and get in exchange for agreeing for this debt ceiling to be raised?
Well, two things. The it's true the United States will reach the debt ceiling in just a few weeks. But the drop-dead date is actually some months away because the Treasury has some room for maneuver, dipping into this fund, to that fund, and that will buy some time. But I wish you were right that nobody wants to see the United States default on its debt by failing to raise the debt ceiling. I wish you were right, but sometimes you hear people, whether from Tea Party or elsewhere, you know, throw all caution to the wind and say, it's better, you know, to stand our ground on principle. We will not agree to raise the debt ceiling unless we get the following changes in government spending and taxation.
Do you think it's actually possible that we would get to a point?
No, I think it would be catastrophic if we did. And for that reason, I think we won't. That cooler heads will prevail and that maybe close to the last minute we will raise the debt ceiling. And maybe it will be part of a bargain to get back where we started this program to do something for 2012 and beyond.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, rather than the debt ceiling in 2012 being two separate sets of decisions and negotiations, combine them into a package that covers both the immediate problem, the next fiscal year, and perhaps beyond that.
Well, just as, again, we have about a minute here, we're going into an election year next year. I'm sure that people will be saying a lot of things about what they think we should or shouldn't do in terms of spending and taxation, about the role of the government. As people listen to this conversation, is there anything, in any particular questions do you think that they should have in their mind, or if they actually even had the opportunity to ask a question, what the question would be?
Yeah. If there's a deal, which there will be, it's just a paper deal or some reality behind it. Is it a deal that simply bridges differences between Democrats and Republicans, or is it a deal that does seriously repair to the financial position of the United States?
Well, there we'll leave it. Our guest, Alan Schick, is professor of public policy at the University of Maryland. He's also a fellow at the senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, has done a lot of writing on budget issues, including authoring the book The Federal Budget, Politics, Policy, Process. That's, in fact, published by the Brookings Institution. And Professor Schick, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you.